Hey friend, welcome to Java with Julie. This podcast is a listener-supported outreach of Authentic Intimacy, a ministry dedicated to reclaiming God's design for sexuality. Well, while it's normal for us to face conflict, challenge, and issues in marriage, it can be hard to recognize when relationships shift and actually become abusive and really unhealthy. My guest today is Christian psychologist Dr. David Clark. David is the author of many books, the host of his own podcast, and is a strong voice in helping victims of abusive relationships get strong, get support, and when needed, get out. The work he is doing is really necessary both outside and within the church walls. The knowledge and wisdom he shares so passionately in this episode is really important for victims of abuse, I would say friends of victims, as well as church leaders to have a deeper understanding into the dynamics that lead to abusive relationships. Now, as you listen to Dr. Clark, you're going to hear his passion come through, and you'll also hear me push back and nuance some of the advice that he's giving. If you or someone you know is in what you think might be an abusive relationship, you need to get help from a counselor who can give you guidance that is specific to your situation. While books and conversations like this one can be really helpful, they can't replace seeking wisdom from someone who can help you navigate your particular situation. In the show notes, we'll put a link to a counseling network that is a great next step for you or someone that might need some help. We'll also link to Dr. Clark's new book, Enough is Enough. For now, grab your Java and join us in the coffee shop as we talk about how to recognize unhealthy relationships and, when needed, how to find a way out. Hey, David, welcome back to Java with Julie. It's been a few years since you've been on.
It has been. You know, I'm a fan of yours, and it's always my pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, I'm just glad you remembered me.
Remembered you. I'm telling you what, you're a tremendous interviewer. You're out of the box, which I like. It's not just the usual, I don't know about your book and throwing things out. You know what the heck you're doing.
Yeah, boy, you set the bar high for me here today, so hopefully I'll achieve that standard. But this one is actually a great book to discuss, and it's a hard interview, but an easy interview. Hard in that this topic is one that no one really wants to talk about, and there's a lot of nuance required, but easy in that you have done a fantastic job in your book, Enough is Enough, of making this very practical. So, I have on my bookshelf a handful of other great resources on this topic, but they're larger books and they're, in general, I think more difficult to navigate through. Well, what do I actually do? So thank you for putting together such a useful resource.
Well, thanks. If nothing else, I am practical and simple. I want to make it very clear, because as you know, Julie, these ladies are in trauma. It's chaos. They need something very clear and specific. And that's what I hope I've given them.
Yeah. And now I have to say, right out of the gate, you've said these ladies, are we only talking to women, or is this book helpful for men who might find themselves in an abusive relationship?
Boy, it's mostly women, but there are some men. My mix so far is 85 with the phone sessions I do, 85 women percent, 15% men. So they're out there.
Yes.
And it's very hard for them. Of course, it's hard for the ladies too, but as a man to admit this, that's not easy to do.
Yeah. Not only admit it, but identify abuse, because it may not be physical abuse where, you know, a woman is overpowering them physically. It might be more emotional, and we can get into that. So yeah. Let's make sure, although we're talking to the majority of here women, let's make sure to remember those guys who might be walking through this too, and maybe even inserting some examples of what that could look like for a man who's in an abusive marriage.
Yeah, I think that's fair too. It goes both ways. Sometimes the guys get hung up on the book because I don't want to go back and forth, so I just talk to the ladies. However, it's just fill in your name. It is for you too, men. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, David, let's start out by defining what an abusive relationship is. And I think it's really important to distinguish between an abusive relationship and an unhappy marriage. Because there are a lot of people who are unhappy in their marriage, and that's a tragedy, but it's a different kind of situation. And the advice you're going to give today doesn't necessarily apply to somebody who's just unhappy in their marriage.
Right. This is a whole nother planet when we're talking about abuse. Oh yeah, I spent 35 years mostly working with normal sort of couples that had normal marriage problems. Those are hard enough, very difficult, thorny. However, now we're shifting with God's grace and his power into this whole new arena the last probably 5 years. Oh, man alive, totally different. And as we make it into this, the church doesn't have a clue about this. They're always kind of behind the curve. But here's how I define abuse. It is a pattern, not once in a while or, gosh, he had a hard day. No, no. A pattern, frankly, a never-ending pattern in many cases of narcissistic, disrespectful, and harmful behavior exhibited by one person in an intimate relationship. Mm-hmm. The basic definition is it's one person slowly destroying another person.
Mm-hmm. So go back and say those qualifiers again. You said an ongoing pattern of, I heard you say disrespectful.
Right. Narcissistic.
Narcissistic.
This is, it's almost axiomatic that the abuser is going to be a narcissist. Not always, but in almost 95% of the cases I'm seeing, incredibly self, this is a world-class selfishness. Mm-hmm. I might be aware of your needs, but I could care less about your needs. You're not even on the radar. It's all about me. And that's 24/7. That really never stops. It's a core of incredible selfishness. They get married not for love, because they can only love themselves. They get married for convenience. You make me look good. You're going to give me children who also will adore me. You might work. Your job is to support me like a pilot fish. Well, that's how these guys actually think. You're not a person.
That certainly might be one type of abusive relationship, but you know, there are other situations, for example, where somebody has a substance abuse problem and they're really nice people, but they are alcoholics. And when they're drunk, they become verbally and physically violent. We would also call that an abusive relationship, right?
Oh, absolutely. See, once they make the choice to use whatever the addiction, it could be sex or alcohol, drugs, gambling, hoarding. And once they make that choice, then they turn into a narc. See, as you said, when they're not using, they could be great people. But when they do use, and they use quite a bit, it's a different story.
Now, substance abuse becomes the big thing in the marriage. It's more important than the people.
Right. Oh, yeah. Whatever you're addicted to, that's number one on your list. And of course, there's no room for the marriage. And I've seen ladies and men put up with this for just years. And it's just awful. What's going to happen today? Is he going to do the addiction? Am I going to find porn on the computer again? Oh, yeah, that's abusive. And there's an element of narcissism. They aren't dyed-in-the-wool narcissists, as I would define them. But when they're using, they are. So there's an element there of incredible selfishness. I'm going to do this because I want to do it.
Okay, so let's paint a picture. What would be some red flags to somebody that your marriage is not just in the unhappy category or difficult category, it's actually crossing that threshold into abusive?
Here's some red flags. There was a constant line of criticism. Could be harsh, could be subtle, but you're just not good enough. You're never going to be good enough. I criticize your weight. I criticize your looks. I criticize the way you talk. I'm correcting you when you talk. I'm criticizing your housekeeping, your mothering, your friends, your family. It's just, you're just not good enough. There's always a steady drone of you're not measuring up. And then in communication, the abuser will only talk about what the abuser wants to talk about. Other topics are simply, if I'm not interested, shut up. If it makes me uncomfortable or triggers me in some way, shut up. If it's something that is a conflict, shut up. I will give you the silent treatment. These guys will do it for, and women, days and weeks and even months, shutting you off. And of course, it's when I decide, of course, it's up to me that this situation's okay now, it's over. We just go on like nothing happened. So there's, you can't talk about anything you actually want to talk about unless I agree I can talk about it.
So what you're describing there, there's been no physical violence, but it's still an abusive pattern within the marriage.
Right. I don't have to touch you to just skewer you, you know, with this emotional thing. And there's no way to, I'm the abuser. There's no way I will allow you to connect with me. I will expect to have sex with you, but that's disconnected to any relationship of any kind. And very often, I mentioned anger. Anger is almost always a hallmark of the abuser. He's triggered by a lot of things. He's got a host of personal issues he's never going to address probably, but everything triggers the guy potentially. So I force you into the codependent role to walk on eggshells all the way around me, never to upset me, because whenever I'm upset, it's your fault. So these ladies just learned to just not to talk about anything.
Yeah.
And it's just incredibly sad. And even that doesn't work. He'll find something else to be upset about.
Mm-hmm.
Also, this a terrible lack of empathy for anything about you and your needs. What you think, I don't care. What you feel, could care less. What your hopes and dreams are, that doesn't make any difference to me. It's what I want. And if I'm the narcissist or slash abuser, then if it makes me happy, well, then it should make you happy. These ladies become invisible, absolutely invisible.
And when you talk about anger, anger doesn't always look like an explosive outburst. Anger can be expressed through punishing behaviors and more critical speech and things like that.
All right. Some will be the obvious abuser will blow up and rage and throw things. I may not touch you. It's more obvious. But yeah, it can be very subtle, but just as destructive. Just with a look, or you're sitting at the table with your family and the kids are there and you say something I don't like, I just stop talking to you. I shut you out. I talk to the kids like you don't even exist. That is a very hostile, angry reaction, but it's not in your face. It's subtle, but frankly, just as effective.
And what makes that difficult, David, is it's very hard to tell that you're in that kind of relationship. You know, I've talked to a lot of women who are in a marriage like that, and they don't see it until they get some perspective or distance. It doesn't feel abusive. They know they're miserable. They know they're anxious. They're on eggshells, but they wouldn't call it abusive.
Boy, isn't that the truth, Julie? You know it. I'm the same way with me. It will take years typically to figure out, oh, this is what's happening. They'll read a book like Enough is Enough. They'll listen to one of your podcasts, your material. They'll one of your books. They'll see me on a video and they'll say, they start to put the pieces together. If they go to church on a regular basis, you're not going to hear about it virtually ever in your basic church. Good people love the Lord, but they're not going to bring it up from the pulpit or anywhere near a Sunday school class. So again, you don't get it.
Why do you think that is? Why don't we talk about it at church?
From my experience, I think it goes way back. It's like the old boys club very often. These are men often in leadership, and they just don't think much of women. They're on a lower level. This is not what the Bible teaches in any way, shape, or form, but there's this, we're right and you're wrong. They misunderstand submission completely. Submission does not apply when you're with a serious sinner who's destroying you. That's true of a basic marriage with a decent man, well, certainly. But they apply that in the wrong way. Plus, a lot of the pastors I've talked to in the past, they're gutless wonders.
Yeah.
They're wimps, and they don't want to confront the narc or the abuser because that might be uncomfortable. Much easier to confront the woman. And they actually believe this lie that the woman somehow is responsible for the success or failure of the marriage. This is not what the Bible teaches. It teaches just the opposite. The man, a lot of requirements for him. Ladies have theirs. But to love your wife as Christ loved the church, and you're the leader, hey, you should go first. But they make the woman go first. I see this over and over again. Of course, a lot of these guys, they will deny that you go to see your pastor. Well, he'll redefine it. That's not abuse at all. This is what most guys are like. And then he'll put the blame on you, or you get the message, well, this is happening, but you know what? You married him, and I'm sorry that you're going to have to make your bed. There's just no help there.
Yeah. Well, David, you know me, I tend to be looking at things with maybe a little more of a gracious light. I hate to call all pastors wimps that aren't addressing this or things like that, or they don't value women. And certainly that is the case in some situations. But I've also seen where you really have a well-meaning pastor who just has no training on this and doesn't know how to recognize abuse. And this is true in the counseling office too. If you have a couple, the narc, as you call them, which narcissist, or the abuser, is going to very, very sometimes skillfully dominate that conversation.
They're good at it.
And the person who is being abused doesn't feel like she has a voice. And so she may be anxious. She may stumble over her words. She may not feel like she can be honest. And so I've seen lots of situations where, again, well-meaning counselors or pastors are not addressing this because they got duped. They were impressed by the narcissist's ability to paint the picture and to describe it through their lens. And if you're not trained in how to look out for this, it's very possible you don't address it. And when we're not addressing it, I think, you know, the average pastor has no idea how common this might be within their congregation, that this needs to be taught on and addressed. So the kind of book that you wrote and these sort of conversations are pushing on the fact that we have to address this, and with the assumption that in every congregation, there are people that are going to need to hear this.
Right. Well, you're right. I a lot of these pastors, because I'm much more, I don't know, I cutthroat, whatever it is. If you have a well-meaning pastor who doesn't get it, number one, don't go to marriage counseling with an abuser. Waste of time, cart before the horse. You right. find someone who understands, and it may not be your pastor. He'll maybe be of spiritual support to you. Okay. He may not know what the heck he's doing, but you find a counselor who's trained, who understands and gets it, and then you start doing your work. And of course, we're hoping, Julie, I think some of this is starting to happen from the feedback I'm getting, that the Enough is Enough book is starting to, if a pastor will read that with an open mind, it's like, oh, they're not being trained like this in seminary. They're not. They don't get it. They have some basic counseling courses. Mostly it's about the Word of God, which it should be, but we're missing this. So I think hopefully we'll start to see things turn, because it means the world. I got a few pastors that I have around the country who get it, and I can direct people to, some here locally that I know, of course, very well, my own pastor, Matthew Hartsfield. They get it. They will come alongside the woman. They'll believe her, and they will move heaven and earth to protect her. It's just so rare, so rare. And we have to hopefully turn the tide.
Yeah. And I'll say, hey, I went through all my training getting a doctorate in clinical psychology. I can't remember ever being trained on how to recognize an abusive relationship. Like, I've learned that in the trenches along the way. But this is not standard fare in your training for any form of counseling or psychology, but it's so critical.
True. Yeah. Same way with me. Not a word. You learn as you go.
Right. And I'm sure I made mistakes. I'm sure there were marriages where there were red flags that I didn't catch or questions I didn't ask. So, this is why this form of conversation education is so important. You have a whole chapter on lies that make me feel like I can't get out, lies that keep me stuck. You hit on some good ones there. Maybe if you want to pick two or three that you feel like are most common.
Yes. One of the classics, of course. And I understand this, because these godly women, especially, and men, they want to follow the Word of God. And I'm in full agreement with that. But they'll think, I have no biblical reason to separate or divorce from this person. That's not true. I think we have a number of verses, which of course I cover in the book, is that the Word of God is most important in this whole enterprise. We want to do it God's way. When you have a serious sinner, there are steps of confrontation. The sinner is given an opportunity to change, okay? But when he does not or she does not, then last stage, you do leave. But that's never talked about in church, so they don't know. Well, that's not the first thing you do. You don't just say, I'm leaving you. No, there are steps to take. So that's one of the lies. I simply have no biblical reason, so I just have to stay. That's not true, right? The second thing is, well, it's better for the children, I think, if I stay with this abuser rather than leaving him or her. Also, not true. The kids are being destroyed. Even if you end up having to leave the man and divorce happens, if God guides you down that road, even half the time with that abuser, if that's what the court indicates, is going to be better for them. But again, that's a lie that keeps them. And of course, one of the classics, and this is legitimate, I cannot make it financially. I cannot. I don't have a job. I work part-time. I don't know where the money is. I can't survive. Again, not true. You're not leaving today. It might be a year. It might be a year and a half. To prepare to have your own job, to get retrained. This is America, not the Middle East. You can do it, but it's just going to take some time. So those are some classic lies that stop ladies, especially, and some men, from leaving when they need to leave.
Yeah. And sometimes it's not even about the financial support. It's about the emotional support. Like, I don't know what I'd do without, or what would my community say if I left?
Right.
And I also want to go back to something you said. Not every boy who grows up in an abusive home will become an abuser or a girl.
No.
But here's the point. They will learn dysfunctional patterns of relationship and how that plays out. You know, some little boys that grow up in abusive homes become very passive, and they don't understand what healthy relationship looks like, or what a husband is meant to do or a father's meant to do. So I 100% agree with your point that if you grew up in an abusive home, it will give you a very dysfunctional map of what intimacy and relationships are meant to look like.
Oh, yeah. It'll mess you up. Oh, yeah. My goodness. And your point about the emotional support, also very good, Julie. That's part of the package in the book, as you know. And you're going to have, you have to have a support team. You don't get out alone. Mm-hmm. And you don't even confront alone. You've got to find a local pastor, it may not be yours, who does get it, who will come alongside, small group, accountability, family. Mm-hmm. It's always a small group. Because if you're married to a narc, an abusive narc, he's going to win the PR battle in many areas because he's that good. Because you haven't broadcasted it.
Would you talk for a minute about a term that has become very popular, but I think most people don't understand, and that's gaslighting?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Classic hallmark of particularly the abusive narcissist. This is driving your partner crazy, affecting her, making her question everything about. I question what you think. I question what you believe. I question what you feel. Here's a good case where I had an older guy gaslighting his wife. He was literally trying to make her doubt. He was starting to see her growing strength, and he didn't like it, her assertiveness, because she was finally sick of it. He would hide her car keys, just like the old movie, hide her car keys, and she couldn't find them. He'd say, I don't know where your car keys are. Oh, my God. He was driving her nuts. And this gaslighting also goes to other people. He'll convince your children you're crazy, you're unstable, you can't be trusted. And then other people around you, your pastor, your even your own family, and they're awfully good at it because they're so smooth and they're world-class liars. And so people tend to believe them. And these ladies are already browbeaten enough and they're traumatized. They start to believe, I think it is me. I think I'm losing my mind. Yeah. I can't trust what I think and feel. Well, it's not true, but they're so relentless. It's like Chinese water torture. They're relentless in their attacks.
Yeah, and that's why one of the first steps of getting out is having that support system, like you mentioned. You know, I've been in the situation of being the friend or the mentor or the counselor who has first said, like, hey, something is very unhealthy in this relationship. This is not normal marriage ups and downs. And usually when you say that, the person hearing it rejects that at first because their true north is gone. Like they can't make sense of what's true anymore. Like you're describing, they're starting to believe that they're the problem. And if you don't have that emotional compass, you're going to need other people that you respect who can do some reality testing for you in the midst of that. But unfortunately, a lot of women in this situation are isolated already. So there aren't eyes on their marriage. There aren't friends who can see what's really happening. What advice do you have for a woman who's listening right now? And that describes her. Like, she's like, I think there's something really unhealthy about my marriage, but I just feel really isolated. I don't even know who to ask.
Yeah. You have to start somewhere, and you got to be very careful about it because a lot of folks won't get it. So you pray about it, you think it through, and you can make approaches to other people, even friends or family. Hopefully family will be on your side, but if you have a dysfunctional family, maybe not. So you choose carefully, and you don't share first, okay, here's what I'm going through. What do you think? Don't take the chance. You will come up with a scenario or two about someone else. Maybe they'll figure it out, but anyway, to see how they'll respond. And you're trying to get a little traction and because you want to be able to trust them and believe them. Then you have to take the plunge and go, look, here's what I'm going through. With the full expectation that you may be rejected. They may not be able to handle it or they won't believe you or they'll just be uncomfortable. And, oh, this is too much for me. And they'll fade. Okay, you just have to move on. Better to always use people who have no connection to your husband, if at all possible, if he's the abuser. Mm-hmm. What you don't want to take the chances is these people getting back to him. Yeah. As spies or something. So you're very careful about this. Celebrate recovery groups, small groups, women's Bible studies are just a gold mine because you come into the group. And of course, you might spend a couple of months getting to know the people and who you can trust based on what they say. And then you'll know, okay, I think Mary over there, I can tell Mary gets it. And then you can start a relationship. So it takes time. But as you said, Julie, it's a gold mine. It's just a breath of fresh air and so empowering when somebody says, I believe you. I know what you're going through, and I will do what I can to support you. When I talk to ladies on the phone, I do all these phone advice sessions, and I say, I've listened to you. You're articulate. You love the Lord. You're very detailed. I believe what you're saying. They usually break down in tears because no one has believed them, or they think that I'm not going to believe them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Man.
Boy, in my experience, it's even less than a woman describing what she's going through and wanting to be validated as her describing what she's going through. And she doesn't believe herself, you know, like, it's just like, it's my fault. I did it. I made him mad. I'm bringing my own mess to this too. And so you might even have to just start with, hey, wait a minute. You know, I think you're believing some lies.
True.
Can I just speak some truth into this? Because again, I think the research shows that most people in an abusive relationship really don't recognize it as abusive until they begin to get out of it.
True. So, that codependent. I've got a book for that too. I got a book for everything, but there's a codependent piece that's vitally important. And that's like the pre-step often. Yeah. To figure out, okay, this is actually true. I'm not crazy. Uh-huh. And so as a friend or as a counselor or as a pastor, man, you could make a huge difference by saying, wait a minute, that's not true.
Yeah.
Here's what is true. I know you. I've seen you. And I believe you. Yeah, that gets the ball rolling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so the ball is rolling. This is not an easy exit strategy, nor does it necessarily always mean we're divorcing. This is taking another step down a road of, I want to pursue health personally. I want to give our marriage the best chance of being healthy. And we'll talk about why that's so key. But what would the next step be? What would you advise somebody to do after the light bulbs begin going off and they realize, wow, I think I might be in an abusive relationship and my support system is starting to tell me that's true?
If at all possible, this starts with you. You've got to get strong enough and healthy enough yourself. You don't leave at that point. You're not ready to leave. You're not ready for all the stuff that will happen if you do leave, or even to begin the process of confrontation. So, you need to, if you can afford it and get money from other sources, go to a solid, licensed Christian counselor who understands and can help you begin to heal. There are trauma bonds that have developed. There's traumatic experiences you've got to work through. You've got to go back into your family of origin and figure out what's happened to me. And you start to, it might take 6, 7, 8 months. You're working on that. You tell the abuser, look, I'm working on me. Normally, they'll accept that because they think you're the problem anyway. I'm working on me. That's where the book, there are some books that can be very helpful, even self-directed books. You're getting healthy. You're getting strong. And very slowly and subtly, even in the relationship, he doesn't know what you're doing, but you're starting to be more assertive. You're starting to speak up a little. Nothing dramatic, because you don't want the blowback, but you're getting stronger, understanding the kids. And so it really starts with the woman or the man. You're getting stronger. You're gearing up. You're developing your support team. You're solidifying that. And God, of course, being the most important person of all, you're leaning on him. You're relying upon him. You're studying the word. You're meditating. This is key. And so you're gathering steam to eventually say, okay, I've had enough. And if it's truly abuse the way I define it in the book, you're leaving. You're separating. The next step, of course, be the financial piece. I've got to maybe see an attorney, not for divorce, but to figure out what money I can take. In many states, it's half and half. You can, right before you leave, you can take half of what money is available. First, you have to find out what's there. Many women don't know. Some men don't either. Okay, you have to get a place. So a lot of things have to fall into place. Mm-hmm. But if you're strong enough, you're going to be able to do it.
Yeah. And part of that preparing is also potentially preparing financially, getting a job. I think back to this old movie, Sleeping with the Enemy, and you and I are about the same age, so you may have seen it. It was Julia Roberts' movie, probably 20 years ago. And she was in a very abusive marriage. And one of her first steps was taking swimming lessons at the Y, because her escape plan was she had to learn to swim. So, I think that's very metaphorical of, you've got to learn to swim, because the waters are about to get really rough when you start setting boundaries. And if you can't emotionally swim, spiritually swim, financially swim, if you don't have those people and resources around you, then you're going to set your first boundary. There's going to be pushback and you're going to give up, and it'll probably be worse than it was to start with.
Right, because you're going to get a lot of blowback. Your basic abuser is going to be nothing short of vicious. He wants control when he sees himself losing control, but it's a man. Oh, that's the last thing he wants. You got to be strong. Mm-hmm. A lot. It used to be back in the day, attorneys would recommend. Now, if there's all kinds of money, maybe not. But most of us don't have all kinds of money. And so you'll need a part-time job at least, maybe a full-time, maybe get retraining. You'll tell the abuser, I'm doing this for our family and to support things. That's not actually not true. You're doing it as you prepare to leave him. But you've got to have a war chest. If you have to go to the divorce route, of course, you have to live on your own for a while. He's not going to give you a dime. Unless mm-hmm. that's forced legally. And if you go the divorce route, okay, well, you're going to have to have a war chest, and it's expensive. So all that takes time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'd also say you need to consult an attorney about the children, because I've seen situations where somebody leaves the home in order to get away from an abusive relationship, and it's considered abandonment of the kids. So it's just good in this process at some point to talk to, I would recommend, a Christian attorney who understands family law, just to know what's the prudent thing to do here. And as you said, it's not because you've determined to get a divorce. It's because there needs to be healthy boundaries set. And in my experience, David, you can tell an abuser by the way they respond to boundaries. So
almost every time.
Yeah.
Exactly. They hate a boundary. Hate it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll set the boundaries here.
Yeah. So if you have an abusive or a spouse who, like, you're thinking could be abusive, and you start to set a boundary like, hey, I want to sleep in the bedroom tonight, or, you know, just something simple, a healthy person is going to say, I don't like that. Tell me why, but I respect it. But an abusive person is going to insist on having their way by being violent, manipulative, verbally abusive, punishing you. And that right there shows you a lot.
It does. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And you've got to find, I'll tell these ladies, you need to find the toughest, you know, Christian attorney you can find. The weak ones or don't understand what's going on and don't understand narcissism. You want somebody tough and strong, because they're going to be your warrior. And you're right. Everything has to be legal. And it depends mm-hmm. on the state.
Mm-hmm.
States have certain limitations and boundaries. Okay, you have to understand all that so you're protected. If you're leaving home, you're not abandoning the home as an asset, and you're not abandoning, if you take your kids, you're not taking the kids away from him. All that has to be set up. There'll be visitation. All that has to be done so you're protected.
Mm-hmm. What about the fear that I'm going to lose my kids? Which is a real fear. It's, hey, if I go down this road, my spouse is more manipulative than I am. Maybe he's gotten the kids on his side of this, and I may lose my relationship with my children.
It's a massive fear, especially for a lady. And the bad, and this is why, this is part of the preparation you'll see in the book, and you know that, Julie, is getting the kids ready, helping them understand what's going on. There's some subtle indirect ways you can do that, that you're going to have to win them over and have a connection. Because this abuser, many will spend years delegitimizing you. And taking care of your authority and turning the kids against you. Oh, my mm-hmm. goodness. So you're going to already have started that process by the time you leave. And the fact of the matter is that he'll threaten. He'll get custody, and you'll be an unfit mother. He'll throw all kinds of threats and charges. Not true. With mm-hmm. the right attorney and with your kids kind of connected to you, that's not going to happen. There is a risk. Depending on the child and how much he's got his hooks into the daughter or son, temporarily, there might be a real problem and they might turn their back on you. Well, this is dad. That's why you want to let the kids know before you leave, this is why I'm leaving. You don't just mm-hmm. leave. This is all, and we want to let them know, here's what's happening. And you're careful. You will say, I will never interrupt your relationship with your father, unless he's a violent person and scary. You'll have legal measures for that. But I will allow, of course, we'll work it out. You can have a relationship with dad, if he's the abuser, and a relationship with me, not going to cut that off. But you also prepare them for what the dad's going to say to them and what he's going to try to do. Because the narc and the abuser will try to turn them totally against you. Mm. We want to get the kids ready for that. So that takes time too.
Mm. David, what about the spiritual covering in all this? And there even has been, I think, some high profile cases where there has been the attempt to go to church and say, hey, this is what's happening in my family, and it's not understood the way it needs to be understood. You know, again, there are pastors who get this and pastors who don't get this, but as a Christian and our commitment to the church body and church discipline, what is the best way to feel like, hey, I have solid spiritual covering, not just psychological help as I'm walking through this?
Well, first and most important, you know, you have the backing of the Word of God, that you are doing the right thing. This is serious sin. We confront that. And if it's not responded to, then last stage, you leave the person. Verse after verse after verse. We have Abigail and Nabal in the Old Testament, 1 Samuel 25. Extraordinary story. She had no rights, none. He could have killed her and people would have cheered. And God still got her out. So you know you have the Word of God. But I recommend to these ladies, find out through any sources you can how your local, your pastor feels about this sort of a situation. If you realize he's not going to be helpful, you don't leave the church because that would, of course, tip your hand. You start doing your research. I'm just telling you, probably going to be a local pastor in your area within 40, 50 miles maybe, who gets it. Mm-hmm. He and his wife could be a key support. Now, it'll be secret until you leave, and then that's the church you're going to, and they will be on your side. You have to find one in your local area, and there usually is one. You just have to find them.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like, you keep saying it'll be secret until you leave, do you feel like the first boundary has to be leaving, or can you make attempts at smaller boundaries along the way?
Yeah, there's very small, subtle things. You don't want to tip your hand to the abuser that, in fact, you're leaving. Now, these guys are smart, and Whitley's, they might figure it out, but you're not going to tip your hand. So there's very subtle steps you can take. Speaking up, even one or two word responses in front of the kids, that's part of the strategy, to let them know what dad's saying is wrong if he's the abuser, and this is inappropriate, and you debrief after events with the kids. There's things you're doing along the way. Oh, by all means, getting ready and getting strong yourself. He won't like that. There'll be some blowback, but it won't be to the level of, I think she's leaving me. Mm-hmm. Because if he asks you if you're leaving me, you will say, no, I'm not. Mm-hmm. That's a Rahab lie. We can live with that because this guy's dangerous. He'll make your life a living hell when he finds out, or she, that you're actually leaving. So there's steps you can take along the way, but the actual plan of leaving, no, that better be a secret as much as you can. Mm-hmm. If he finds out or he smells a rat, okay. Not much you can do about that, but you'll still deny it. And we're just living here.
Yeah. If this is an extremely violent situation, I would agree with you on that. But if it's not, I might have a different take on that, you know, because I think there are situations where you're raising some red flags and you're saying, I don't like the way you're talking to me. I don't like the way you're treating me. You know, I'm going to counseling to get help. I'm learning to set these boundaries, you know, because the reality of it is, most abusive situations are not all or nothing. It's not they're extremely violent, horrible, awful, dangerous people, or they're completely safe. There's a continuum. So I don't know what you think about that, but I think there are situations where you don't keep it a secret. You don't lie. It's not that you just like pull out all the guns at one time, but you're using your voice and setting boundaries and confronting along the way.
And when this is part of my work, when I talk to a lady on the phone or a man, I got to get the background. I don't know yet the lay of the land to see what we're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And if it is, even if it's not a physically violent guy, let's say, or a woman, if they are just vicious, out of control, attacking, ruining your life, okay, and the blowback will be intense, okay, then you're going to have to go more secretive.
Right.
But if it's short of that, then you can, and even in front of the kids, you can be a little more assertive. And there are certain cases where you can even, there's some confrontation while you're in the home. I'm, for whatever reason, I'm not getting those cases.
Yeah.
I'm getting where the guy is a monster.
Yeah.
And
no,
so we're,
I'm seeing cases where it's somewhere in between, you know, and there is that Matthew 18 of first we confront them, then we take another person, you know, and there are situations where that works. And I've seen situations, for example, where someone has extreme PTSD. And their core nature isn't narcissistic, but they've become abusive because they can't manage their anxiety and they're triggered. And so, you know, I think there are shades of gray here. And in extreme cases, it does require, you know, that planned exit that's kind of a final boundary. But I think that there's nuance here for cases that aren't that extreme.
Yeah, what does shades of gray mean? Dr. Clark's not good at shades of gray.
That's why you have me.
I guess so. We need a balance here.
Yeah, that's right.
And that's why the counselor is very, whether it's me or somebody else, and I'm not the ongoing guy, I just kind of get the ball rolling. Yeah, you have a thorough evaluation. You're getting stronger along the way and finding out what you can and can't do as you prepare to leave. Mm-hmm. Very important. And it depends. Mm-hmm. I've talked to men on the phone who are narcissists, and they admit they are, but they're calling. I had a guy today. I'm calling in, and it looks like he gets it. Oh, that's a different story. Because your dyed-in-the-wool abusive narc is never going to call me. He hates me. If he even knows me, he could care less. So I call them semi-narcissists. Okay, there's hope for them, and they're out there.
Yeah.
And so that's a different story. So we got to figure out what you're dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just coming across more of the abusive narcs these days. Yeah. And that's secret. That is, put your ducks in a row, leave first, and then the Matthew 18 confrontation steps. But there are cases where, you could do that first if, in fact, it's not an extreme situation where you're really at risk of blowback.
Yeah. Well, that kind of goes along with, you're like, there is hope for some of these guys. And one of your main steps is give your abuser a chance. And again, this is after the separation has occurred. And because really, neither of you can see the reality of how messy the relationship is until you get away from it, until you get other eyes on it.
Right.
So,
and it's not, it is a safety thing, but also I think you're indicating, Julian, you're right. A separation is often helpful. Just we have to each get our work done. And you can't do that in the same home very often. There's so much going on, the dynamic's so strong. So we're safe and there's confrontation. If that guy's going to, of course, he might want right back in. No, we're going to take some time here to make sure we're both healthy. And that's why separation is also a very good idea in these cases.
So what does it look like to give the abuser a chance? Flesh that out.
Okay, you're out. Let's say you're out. And because Dr. Clark wants you to be out. Okay, you're out. And you got your kids. The first month, there's not much connection. He might be able to see the kids. Let's say the abuser's the guy. You've left him. You've got your attorney on the job and the money's right and you're getting settled in. And that month is very important to see what his reaction's going to be. If it's vicious, if it's nonstop abuse, if it's I'm going to divorce you, if it's all kinds of hideous threats, okay, that's not going to go well. If, however, it is I'm sorry, now you don't take that to the bank, but it's okay, it's something to I'm sorry, I'll do whatever it takes, and it's consistent. He's still seeing the kids because that's legal. That's when we start with the Matthew 18. In a very real sense, you have already done the first step of Matthew 18. You've probably done that a million times over the course of your marriage, confronting the sin. So now we go through the rest of the steps. And not personally, but through one of your key support persons, that's the one or two witnesses, you will give him, if it looks like he's really interested, you will give him a list of the eight things in the book of what repentance looks like. Here's what you're going to have to do. And it's a tough list. If you want your wife back, here's what you're going to have to do. No guarantees you even get her back. We put him in that quarter. The right guy, I haven't seen it different in 40 years of work. He will move heaven and earth. He'll make the changes. With God's help, he'll win you back. It will work. The wrong guy won't. He'll start and then fade, and he'll turn on you like a snake. He'll blame you. He'll get an attorney, all wrong. But we're giving him a chance. If the one or two witnesses step doesn't work and he blows it off, okay. Now we go to the church, your supportive pastor. There's a confrontation. And then if that doesn't work, okay, you're already separated. Then God has to direct your path.
What are some of those eight things? And I think, again, this can be different in situations. There are some basic ones, but in some situations it would be you need to take your medication every day, or you need to check in with your accountability group. But I would guess for everyone it would be some form of intervention like therapy, some form of help. What would be some other standard expectations?
Well, number one, to make this clear, he's going to be an individual therapy with someone who understands narcissism / emotional abuse. It's someone that you have chosen for him. He doesn't have to see the person. He also doesn't have to win you back. You're not going to say, well, find somebody. No, here's the person I'd like you to see. They've already been vetted. This is what you're not going to tell him. Your support people will tell him. He's going to write out the entire history, and he's got 3 months to do this. You're not in a hurry. 3 months to put together an entire letter, and it might be 40 pages long, of all the things he's done to abuse you. See, he can't write that right now because he doesn't even know what he's doing. But as he does the work with his therapist, it will become clear, That was abuse. That was abuse. That was, if he's going to do the work and he writes that out, that's he doesn't care if it's used in court. He's just laying it out there. That is a good test of a man to see, hey, plus it's also good for him clinically. Here's what I've been like. Plus with his work, he's figuring out, why am I like this? He's not going to blame you. It's my fault. I figured out where this, no excuse, but I figured out where this has come from. Mm-hmm. There's going to be a key spiritual component, of course. He's going to be in church every time the door is open. He's going to have a relationship with the pastor who also understands abuse. Someone else you can recommend. He'll be in a men's small group. He'll have an accountability person, absolutely, who will be vetted and also offered to him, and who will guide him through this. Men coming around men, important, ladies with ladies. So those are some key spots. Now, the financial piece, here's a beauty, and this will test him too. He's going to actually, and we'll make this as legal as we can, he will actually, in the event of a divorce, which we don't want, but he will lay out, not only will he support you during the separation fully financially, but he will now say, if we divorce, and you can make that choice today if you want, because you already have the reason, but I don't want you to, here's what I'll do. Here's, and it'll be a very fair agreement. Will he do that? I don't know. If he doesn't, you're pretty much done. So these are tough standards, but the right guy will say, I'm just glad to have a list, and, and I'm going to work this list, and you just watch me. Mm-hmm. And I've seen guys do it. Not many, but I've seen some do it.
How long do you give a guy? I mean, even if his initial response is not good, do you wait and keep waiting on the Lord and praying for a year, 2 years, 5 years? I know, again, there's probably no set timeline, but give an idea of how long we wait for God to work.
I'll tell ladies 3 to 6 months. That's more than enough time. Mm-hmm. Okay. It really is. If it's consistently, I hate you, I can't believe you, you have no right to leave me, I'm trying to turn the kids against you, if it's just character assassination, he won't do anything on the list, okay. Mm-hmm. Game over. Now, God has to guide you to divorce. But that's what I say. I see ladies who await. Last week, I talked to one. It's been 5 years, and they've been separated, and the guy's shown nothing. I said, I think that might be long enough. Let God be your guide. She's still caught in codependence. That 5 years? That's too long.
Yeah.
Unless God's making it clear he's supposed to wait. Mm-hmm. That's not God. That's somebody else. So I think 3 to 6 months, I just, you know what? Come on. That's more than fair. The right guy will turn around in 3 months. He will. He'll start to work because it's dawning on him. He does love you, and he realizes things. Yeah, I wouldn't wait super long. I just wouldn't.
What would you advise a woman to communicate to her community about this and her family as all this is transpiring?
Yeah, good question. You want to tell the truth, and you want to do it in love. We don't trash the man. It'd be tempting because there's a lot of material. You simply say, so you make general statements. Now, your inner core, people that you really trust, maybe two or three people, they get the details. Your counselor, your pastor, your attorney, I don't know, maybe your mother, key people, they know everything because you have to heal and they can know everything. As it widens out from there in concentric circles, you will simply say, Mike was abusive to me, and it was difficult, and it was affecting me, it was killing me physically, emotionally, spiritually, and I've had enough. It's a general statement. They don't have to know. People want to know more. You don't tell them more, and you'll say, there's prayer involved here. He has a chance to change. It's up to him. So I'd go general. Plus, you don't have the energy to tell all kinds of people the story. It would exhaust you and break you. So you know what? It's a small core. The children need to know the truth. They do. Again, not to trash him, but to say clearly, here's why I'm leaving. Here's why I'm doing this. They have to have reasons. Unless they're super small, they have to know mom has a reason or dad has a reason to leave. You're not trashing the person, but you're telling the truth.
Mm-hmm. David, as this book has gotten out in the Christian community, what kind of feedback have you gotten or pushback?
Oh boy, a little bit of both. Dr. Clark always gets that. You know that.
Yeah.
So go with the haters first. Oh, narcissists whose wives have gotten hold of the book and have left them. Oh, the hatred. Of course, I don't respond to those. We just delete those. But oh, it's nasty. But I feel like I'm doing something right. I can't believe you're a liar. This isn't biblical. All of a sudden, they're biblical scholars. I've been to two seminaries. But anyway, I don't respond. So haters, even pastors, spiritual leaders, think I'm out of line. What I have going, and this is a God thing, of course, Moody Publishers, who you can trust. This book went through an incredibly extensive editing process, which I hated, but it turned out to be really wonderful. And so, and they can't argue with that because Moody's not going to publish a book that isn't solidly biblical. They're not going to do it. So that isn't in my favor, but I got a lot of haters, but I'm getting many. It's 95%. Thank you. You heard me. This is my life. This gives me a plan. I have a plan of action, and I've got hope for the first time in 20 years, 30 years, 15 years, 10 years. So we're getting a lot of great feedback amongst the haters. But I don't care about haters. I just move on. Doesn't bother. I'm not a sensitive person. You probably can tell that, Julie. It doesn't bother me.
Yeah.
We're doing the right thing. And God is showing us, this is what I want you to do. As you said, we're saving people. We are.
Boy, I'm grateful for David and his commitment to helping people set boundaries and confront abusive dynamics. Abusive behaviors leave huge negative impacts on individuals and families. So having the tools to discern these situations and relationships and the knowledge of what to do next can literally help save lives. The link to David's book, Enough is Enough, A Step I Plan to Leave an Abusive Relationship with God's Help, as well as additional resources like a link to Focus on the Family's Counseling Network, will be included in our show notes and at AuthenticIntimacy.com. Well, friend, thanks so much for listening to today's episode, and I hope you join me next time for Java with Julie.